at least in mammals. It also requires changes in female reproductive anatomy to accommodate larger craniums during childbirth. Third, brains are extremely energy hungry and thus place intense demands on organisms to acquire enough calories to support them. For example, the human brain consumes about 20% of the body's daily energy expenditures, more than any other single organ. The fact that so many long-persisting lineages, such as sharks, horseshoe crabs, and turtles, never bothered to evolve big brains, underscores how costly and improbable it is. But big and smart brains did evolve in humans, despite the costs and anatomical constraints. Therefore, this would seem to be a triumph of good design, hardly a defect. But a closer look reveals that our large and powerful brains may actually be the biggest flaw of all. Most anthropologists agree that the initial phase of the expansion of human intelligence took place over the first 4 or 5 million years of our species' divergence from the chimp lineage, and was marked by the shift to larger and more intricately cooperative social groups. As our ancestors shifted to a bipedal posture and eked out a living at the borderlands of dense rainforests and grassy savannas, they began to creatively master a broader range of survival skills. They needed expanded cognitive abilities to perform these complex skills, but also to learn them. Through the human lineage, our species gradually made a transition from pre-programmed behaviors and skills to learned ones. Much of the learning took place socially, with one individual teaching another. Thus, skills and social interactions were linked, and both evolved together, pushing the human brain toward ever greater abilities. As upright posture freed our ancestors' hands to carry things and make tools, and as growing brains and larger groups facilitated social learning, humans found themselves in the perfect environment for the emergence of more complex forms of communication and cooperation. Cooperation requires perspective-taking and empathy. In order to really cooperate with you, I must be able to imagine how events will unfold from your point of view. In order for people to work effectively in teams, each member of a group must have some appreciation for what the other members in the group are seeing, thinking, and feeling. Our ancestors took cooperation and sociality to dramatic new heights, and their powerful intelligence played a key role in that until about 1.5 million years ago. Brain expansion in our ancestral lineage suddenly accelerated dramatically. Human brains have grown more than twice as much over the past 1 million years than they did in the 5 million years before that. What happened to facilitate that rapid change? Recent studies have indicated that the rapid acceleration of brain growth in our ancestors was likely due to a switch to more competitive strategies for survival. At this time, there were several species of hominids vying for similar habitats and resources. In addition, even within the same species, different social groups would compete with one another when their territories overlapped. Competition among groups of animals is nothing new, of course, but our ancestors approached this competition with dramatic new cognitive abilities. This is where things get very dark. Humans engage in competitive behaviors that are downright Machiavellian. We manipulate, deceive, entrap, and terrorize. To do this, we use many of the same skills that serve us well for cooperation. Perspective taking, predicting another person's next move, and so on. In other words, throughout our evolutionary history, we began using our impressive cognitive powers for good, but then we turned to the dark side. And, like Anakin Skywalker becoming Darth Vader, that's when we grew really powerful. To see the evolutionary legacy of this adaptation, look no further than today's headlines. Humans are capable of unspeakable violence toward one another. We plot against one another with ruthless cunning and complete disregard for others' suffering. The surprising part is that our ancestors didn't sacrifice their cooperative, pro-social, even altruistic nature in the process of becoming so ruthless. They kept both sides, becoming a species of Dr. Jekylls and Mr. Hydes. The duality of human nature is the hallmark of the human experience. We can switch from boundless love and great self-sacrifice to cold-blooded murder, even genocide, in a heartbeat. Just a few generations ago, the United States of America and many other countries were populated by men who were loving fathers and doting husbands, and who made their fortunes by brutally enslaving other human beings. By all accounts, Adolf Hitler was a generous and gentle partner to Eva Braun, even as he ordered the senseless slaughter of millions. How can such unspeakable monstrosity and genuine affection coexist in the same species, let alone the same individual? Because evolution rewarded those of our ancestors who could nimbly switch between cooperation and competition when the conditions suited them. We evolved to be highly social, collaborative, and altruistic, but also ruthless, calculating, and heartless. It is this latter set of traits that seemed to facilitate the evolution of our great big brains. So the next time you praise someone's intelligence, stop to think about what, or rather who, had to be sacrificed in order for her to get that smart. Epilogue. The Future of Humanity. Why humans are still evolving, despite what you may have heard. Why all civilizations, including our own, may be destined to implode and rebuild in an endless cycle. Why we may live indefinitely healthy lives in the not-too-distant future. Why technological advancement has both raised the possibility of our self-destruction and provided us with the means to avoid it, and more. This book has surveyed only a fraction of the defects in the human body. We have many other mental biases, countless additional problems with our DNA, and lots of other useless, or needlessly complex or breakable, body parts among myriad sundry flaws not mentioned here. Any book attempting to cover all human imperfections would need to be much, much bigger than this one, and much more expensive. You're welcome. That said, our many flaws should not make us feel bad about ourselves. After all, evolution works by random mutation and survival of the fittest, not of the perfect. Such a haphazard approach to life could never produce perfection. Every species is a balancing act of positives and negatives. Great as humans are, we are no exception. But when it comes to imperfections, the human story is unique. We do seem to be more flawed than other animals, and the reasons why, paradoxically, come from adaptations that really should have been improvements. For example, the reason we must pursue such a diverse diet in order to stay healthy, while other animals can survive on a single type of food, is that our ancestors were able to break free from the monotony of subsisting on staples and use their great cognitive powers to forage, hunt, gather, dig, and otherwise seek nutrition from every conceivable food source across multiple habitats. That sounds like a good thing. But the problem is that, as their minds grew powerful, their bodies grew lazy. Basking in the variety of their rich diets, their bodies simply quit bothering to make many nutrients that they previously did. This forced our ancestors to switch from being able to enjoy a rich diet to requiring a rich diet in order to survive. That's an unfortunate switch. What was clearly an advantage to start with, being voracious omnivores, became a limitation. This same logic applies broadly to human anatomy and physiology. Our species' physical form is the result of compromises forged by evolution, as humans became the ultimate generalists. There are species that can run faster, climb higher, dig deeper, or hit harder. But humans are special because we can run, climb, dig, and hit. The phrase, jack of all trades, master of none, fits us perfectly. If life on Earth were like the Olympic Games, The only event that humans would ever win is the decathlon, unless chess became an Olympic sport. Other problems we experience with our bodies are due to the many differences between the environment our ancestors evolved in and the environment humans now live in. Those differences lead to so-called mismatch diseases, such as obesity, atherosclerosis, type 2 diabetes, and many other disorders. Much of these problems of environmental mismatch stem from differences between our ancestors' diet and ours. But another big difference between how our ancestors lived in the early Stone Age and how we live now has to do with technology. Because technology has allowed us to move beyond the physical limitations of our bodies, it would seem like a purely advantageous phenomenon. However, the less we rely on our bodies, the less they are pressed to adapt and evolve. Now that we are solving so many of our problems with technology instead of biology, it's no surprise that our bodies are not exactly in tip-top shape. Of course, humans are not the only species to use technology. For our purposes, I'm defining technology as methods, systems, or devices crafted for their utility in performing a task. And by this broad definition, many animals make use of technology. Macaques use rocks to crack nuts, and chimpanzees shape sticks to use in their hunt for termites, to give a couple of examples. In our species' case, early humans used simple stone tools. But unlike macaques and chimps, who are still using the same tools that they have wielded for millions of years, humans' invention of stone tools ushered in a new kind of evolution that has set us apart from every other animal under the sun, and for which there is no turning back. Cultural evolution. Cultural evolution refers to the social practices, knowledge, and even languages that are passed on through the generations. While animals certainly learn some things from one another, humans have taken the concept of culture to the extreme. Almost everything we do and experience in our lives is the result of culture, and this has been the case for quite a long time. Once modern humans began sharpening rocks, building dwellings, and eventually planting crops, they began to succeed or fail based on cultural features rather than biological ones. In a sense, we have taken charge of our own evolution. But are we really in control? As technology and culture continue to advance, what changes are in store for us? Now that we understand how our biology and culture evolved, are we able to manipulate them at will, and therefore shape human destiny in a deliberate and intentional way? Or will we continue to plow ahead in the same random, haphazard manner that we have for the past 7 million years? In short, what does the future hold for our species? Are we done evolving? Some high-profile people in the scientific community, including Sir David Attenborough, have asserted that humans have developed so far in our civilization and technology that we have fully escaped the forces of evolution. We are no longer evolving, they say, and our species will remain more or less the same in its biology, absent any intentional tweaks that we accomplish. There may be some truth to this. Existential challenges are the hallmark of evolutionary theory, and one of the key observations that led Darwin to his great discovery. Yet today we face very few of these challenges relative to the thousands of generations that came before us. The vast majority of human beings who are born today will survive to reproductive age. Starvation is rare, at least in developed nations. Physical injuries and illnesses are now routinely overcome by modern medicine. Fighting to the death is also rare. Murder is punished. Even warfare has waned tremendously. A nice, long life is pretty much assured for most people alive today. Furthermore, reproduction is not nearly as competitive as it once was. Although those with great physical strength and stamina may attract more desirable mates, they don't, as a rule, leave more offspring. The same is true for intelligence, a strong work ethic, or good looks. For humans, through the Pleistocene epoch, things like eyesight, dexterity, speed, endurance, intellect, popularity, health and vitality, dominance status, and even attractiveness had a direct impact on the number and success of one's children. But nowadays, being successful at life, either socially or professionally, doesn't generally mean that someone leaves more offspring. As I'll explain in a moment, it may actually mean that he or she leaves less. Even major medical problems and limitations don't automatically reduce the risk of having successful children. The usual forces of natural selection have largely been neutralized. Natural selection may not be shaping us anymore, but evolution is still at work. Evolution simply refers to any genetic change in a species over time. Natural selection, the phenomenon that picks winners and losers through their survival and reproduction, is just one way that a species can evolve. It's the one we think the most about, but there are other evolutionary forces that can be just as powerful. So, yes, humans may indeed have managed to escape the scourge of natural selection, but that doesn't necessarily mean that evolution is over for us. A species can evolve any time that reproduction is non-random. If some specific group of individuals reproduces more than other groups, that group will contribute more to the gene pool of the next generation. Assuming that the difference inherent in that group has a genetic component to it, this demographic change makes evolution inevitable simply by introducing a gradual genetic change into the species. We know that this is happening in the human population because some groups are indeed reproducing more than others. First, birth rates are very low in developed countries and are continuing to fall. The population in Japan is currently shrinking. The populations of several Western European countries, such as Italy, France, and Austria, would be doing the same were it not for immigration. This means that the contribution of the Japanese and ethnic Central and Western Europeans to the future gene pool of the species is getting smaller and smaller. Second, within a given country, whether developed or underdeveloped, some people reproduce more than others. This is not random. People with higher socioeconomic status have better access to education and more resources for birth control, both of which tend to be correlated with smaller family sizes. Many choose to forgo reproduction altogether. This ends up meaning that people with lower socioeconomic status tend to leave more offspring than do richer, more educated people. That could be considered a form of evolution, too. Besides economics, things like religion, education level, career advancement, family background, and even political beliefs all affect reproductive rates. In the West, these many factors influencing reproduction do not break down evenly across the various racial and ethnic groups because of the long history of racial oppression and ongoing social and political structures that reinforce inequality. This means that in North America and Western Europe, people of African and Latino origin tend to have more children than non-immigrant Caucasians. But even this trend is not uniform, and there are strong regional differences, making it all but impossible to predict where these evolutionary pressures are directing the species as a whole. Even the trends themselves are fluid. In Asia, too, there are wide differences between reproductive patterns in different regions. Large families are completely unheard of in China, Japan, India, and most of Southeast Asia, while countries like Pakistan, Iran, and Afghanistan have sky-high birth rates. Over time, these differences in birth rates will change the ethnic breakdown of our species. They also prove that the reproductive success of these various human ethnic groups is non-random, a precondition for evolution. It's true that differential survival is not a major phenomenon, at least not in the developed West. But differential reproduction certainly is. It doesn't matter that the differences are due to conscious reproductive choices. It's still unequal reproductive success. That's evolution. Where is all of this leading? It's hard to say. But it's worth pointing out that racial and ethnic groups that had once been mostly isolated from one another are now in contact as never before, and intermarriage is happening at increasing rates. This could lead to the merging of the human species back into one interbreeding population, something that has not occurred, in all likelihood, since our species first originated in a small corner of Africa a couple of 100,000 years ago. Beyond that possibility, one thing can be said with absolute certainty. The only constant in life is change. To see how true this is, you need only look to the stars. Are we really the best nature can do? Enrico Fermi is one of the most important figures in modern nuclear physics. Among the many programs he was involved in was the Manhattan Project, in which he helped establish the conditions for a sustained nuclear reaction, a key component in the atom bomb. During a visit to Los Alamos, where the first bomb had been built less than 10 years before, Fermi joined a casual conversation with Edward Teller and other scientists around a lunch table. This was at the height of the 1950s space race, and they were discussing the physical and technical barriers to traveling at near-light speed. Most of the scientists eventually agreed that such rapid transit would one day be invented, and the conversation turned to guesses about when, not if, humans would achieve these great speeds. Most of those around the lunch table assumed that it would be a matter of decades, not centuries. Suddenly, Fermi did some quick calculations on a napkin demonstrating that the galaxy had millions of planets similar to Earth. If interstellar travel was theoretically possible, then where is everybody? He suddenly blurted out. The shocking realization that Fermi had while chatting over lunch that day was that the universe was eerily absent of non-natural radio signals. He and other scientists had been analyzing electromagnetic waves throughout the cosmos for many years. They had detected signals from very far away, millions and billions of light years away. But they had heard only the regular, repetitive signals from stars and other celestial bodies. They'd never heard anything that could possibly be a form of communication, as far as they could tell. That realization was more than 60 years ago. And we still haven't heard anything but the background buzz of stars, planets, quasars, and nebulae. Nor have we been visited by alien life, that we know of. Which leaves us with the uncomfortable question. If we do turn out to be the only intelligent life in the universe, what does that say about life in the first place? And what does it say about us? As Fermi knew, the universe is billions of years old and contains billions of galaxies. Even our own Milky Way, a run-of-the-mill spiral galaxy, contains hundreds of millions of stars, each one of which could be orbited by a planet harboring intelligent life. Furthermore, from what we can tell from the fossil record, life on Earth started almost as soon as conditions were favorable. There was very little delay after the Earth cooled before life began buzzing along, well on its way toward evolving into complex organisms. This argues that life not only can evolve, but will evolve on a lifeless planet when the temperature and chemical composition are right. The vastness of the universe inspired Dr. Frank Drake to develop a mathematical formula, now known as the Drake Equation, that attempts to estimate how many civilizations exist in the universe. There are many variables in the Drake equation, including the number of galaxies in the universe, the number of stars per galaxy, the rate of new star formation, the percentage of stars that have planets, the fraction of those planets that exist in the habitable zone, which allows liquid water, the odds that life will begin, the chances that life will evolve to the point of having intelligent beings capable of transmitting signals into space, and so on. None of these are perfectly knowable variables, but all can be estimated using current knowledge and the laws of probability. While there are huge disagreements about the utility of the Drake equation, some current estimates predict that the universe harbors around 75 million civilizations. The estimates constantly change, of course, as our knowledge of the universe improves. Even before the Drake equation was articulated, with so many billions of stars and planets, Fermi reasoned that the universe should be teeming with life. Moreover, alien civilizations could be very far ahead of us in terms of technological development. Most sci-fi movies imagine aliens that are just a couple hundred years beyond where we are now, but the universe is nearly 14 billion years old, and stars and planets have existed for most of that time. Our solar system is relatively young, at 4.6 billion years of age. There could be civilizations with billions of years on us in terms of their technology. They might be able to travel enormous distances the way we travel through cities. Enrico Fermi's question became known as the Fermi paradox, summed up as, "In a universe as old and vast as ours, why have we not yet heard from alien life?" There are many possibilities to this as yet unanswered question. One possible explanation is that alien civilizations take care to hide their presence from us. An extreme expression of this notion is the planetarium hypothesis, which states that some sort of protective sphere has been built around us to filter out the noises from extraterrestrial civilizations, but allow the background cosmic signals through. Even if advanced alien civilizations have the ability and desire to keep us from hearing them, they would certainly be able to hear us. After all, we have been transmitting radio waves into space continuously since the 1930s. Traveling at the speed of light in all directions, our transmissions exit the solar system within a couple of hours, and have been reaching other stars and their planets for decades. There are at least 9 stars within 10 light-years of Earth, and at least 100 stars within 25 light-years. Though our signals would be very weak by the time they reached that far, we would expect that an advanced civilization would also be advanced in its ability to monitor the signals coming from the surrounding stars and galaxies. They would know that we exist, as well as quite a bit about us. I wonder if that's why no one's come. Another explanation is that our assumptions are wrong, and life is exceedingly rare in the universe. Maybe the rapid germination of life on Earth was an incredibly unlikely fluke, and the other rare places that have been so lucky are so far away that radio signals have not had time to travel between them and us. Nevertheless, just in our local neighborhood of the Milky Way, we know that there are hundreds of thousands of planets in the sweet spot range of temperatures necessary to sustain the kind of chemistry we see on Earth. Planets with the chemical composition of Earth and near the same temperature range are pretty common in the universe. While we don't have nearly enough information to determine much about what those planets are like, there is no reason to think that Earth was special in any way at the time that life got started. Perhaps the most boring possible explanation is that every science fiction book and film is wrong, and our current barriers to interstellar travel are ultimately insurmountable. Stars are very far from one another, and at this time, we know of no way to exceed the speed of light, or even get anywhere near it. In fact, the conversation in which Fermi raised his question was actually an argument about the odds of humans having vehicles that could approach light speed in 10 years' time. Fermi guessed 10%. That was more than 65 years ago, and we're no closer now than we were then to traveling at speeds anywhere close to light speed. If there simply aren't any solutions, and standard jet propulsion is the best we're ever going to do, the many civilizations throughout the universe are destined to remain isolated from one another forever. We will stare at the stars, bored and lonely, while other beings stare back, but we'll never actually meet each other. But still, why aren't we at least hearing their signals? There is another explanation, an even darker one, that many scientists, myself included, are starting to worry about. It may be that life is relatively commonplace in the universe, but it appears and disappears over unfathomably immense timescales during periods that rarely, if ever, overlap. In other words, advanced alien civilizations are not out there waiting to be found because they no longer exist. And in all likelihood, the fate that befell them will also befall us. Developmental implosion. Think about it. Human beings are on a collision course with our own industrialization. We are consuming non-renewable, or very slowly renewable, resources at an unsustainable pace. Coal, oil, and gas are finite resources. Even if there is a lot left, there is not an infinite amount left. We are converting rainforests, which produce the majority of our breathable oxygen, and consume the majority of the carbon dioxide, into land for farming or housing. Our population is growing so fast that our ability to provide food for each person will be in serious doubt within a generation. Despite all of our scorched earth efforts to extract more and more sustenance from the planet. Meanwhile, climate change is threatening major coastline developments, some ocean ecosystems are in all-out collapse, and biodiversity throughout the globe is plummeting. We are in the midst of a mass extinction caused almost exclusively by our own actions. Who knows how bad things will get before we bottom out? That's not even the worst of it. Weapons of mass destruction have raised the specter of mutually assured destruction, which was actually a delicate deterrent for a time, but may not hold for long. Radical messianic and apocalyptic ideologues may be impervious to deterrence, and it seems inevitable that they will one day get their hands on the ultimate weapon. What will restrain them from using it? In addition, when world resources become scarce, strife will abound. Strife brings forth the worst in us, and economic and cold wars culminating in hot wars seem almost certain, with the stakes far higher than ever before. Add to these dangers the very good chance that a pandemic could strike at any point. Humans now exist in such density that infectious diseases spread like wildfire. When we add to this the ease of global travel, a doomsday scenario is not hard to imagine. All of these factors compound the others, increasing the danger that one or another of these tragedies will someday occur. Lack of farmable land raises food prices. Strain on energy resources raises all prices. High prices cause strife and unrest, which tends to favor the rise of dictators. Global warming will place the most pressure on the least developed regions, exacerbating their problems. Continued invasion of the rainforest will tap previously dormant viruses and provide them with a new and densely populated host. Bringing all of this together produces a grim picture. Are we on a clear path to our own demise? There are literally thousands of ways to imagine how our species could suffer tremendous setbacks in the coming century. But at this point, extinction of Homo sapiens seems very unlikely. Given that humans live basically everywhere on the planet, there will always be people with the forethought, tenacity, and luck to get through whatever crises may come. Sure, without a complete redirection of our species' current trajectory, major economic and political collapse may be likely. But I have little doubt that some humans would survive an apocalyptic scenario, and the species would go on, even if the destructive implosion causes mass death and suffering, as well as huge setbacks in technology and development. The risks we now face as a species, dangers that are completely attributable to our own ambition, might very well be the normal way of things in the universe. If life has emerged on another planet, we can only assume that natural selection shapes that life more or less the same way it does ours. This is because natural selection is an extension of simple logic. Those who survive and reproduce well will leave more offspring than those who do not. It's hard to imagine life working any other way on another planet, despite how different everything and everyone might appear on the surface. However, never have we seen, and never, alas, could we predict, the evolution of disciplined self-control, long-range foresight, rampant selflessness, generous self-sacrifice, or even something as simple as willpower. Evolution has never shown an ability to plan ahead more than a generation or two. Evolution has made us entirely selfish. Of course, as a social species, we have an expanded sense of self that includes children, siblings, parents, and anyone else we are closely affiliated with. We make sacrifices for our children because we see them as part of us. But with this expanded sense of self comes limits. Our siblings and even our friends might be us, but certain strangers aren't. Maybe we can expand further and say that people of one's race, religion, or nationality constitutes us, but that still leaves a them. In the same way that humans evolved to feel parental love, we evolved to hate or fear those who are not us. This is true in all social mammals. So we have every reason to believe that life on another planet would follow this same logic. It may be that we have never seen, heard, or been contacted by aliens because their civilizations simply collapsed under the weight of their own selfishness, technological advancement, and a host of other exacerbating factors before they gained the ability to leave their solar system. We ourselves are tantalizingly close to unlocking the secrets of space travel, harnessing endless energy from the sun, and keeping our bodies healthy indefinitely. But we also may be just as close to catastrophic collapse. Perhaps the same scenario repeats itself throughout the history of the universe. Endless boom and bust cycles, where a civilization almost takes the crucial next steps before blowing itself back to the agrarian days, if it's lucky, and starting all over again. Our impending collapse may be unavoidable, given our evolutionary design. Our desires, instincts, and drives are the product of natural selection, which does not make long-term plans. Chaos, death, and destruction may be the true natural state of the universe and of all species, including ours. To borrow a quote from the legendary science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke, two possibilities exist. Either we are alone in the universe or we are not. Both are equally terrifying. Immortality within our reach. Death is a fact of life for every living thing, and humans are no exception. Nevertheless, humanity has been obsessed with death and how to prevent it, or at least delay it, since the dawn of time. The oldest recorded story in the world, the Epic of Gilgamesh, is about the hero's quest for everlasting life. In the West, the legends of the Philosopher's Stone, the Fountain of Youth, and the Holy Grail center on the secret to immortality. In the East, foundational stories in Hinduism, the Amrita elixir, Chinese medicine, Ling Ji, the supernatural mushroom, Zoroastrianism, the sacred drink Soma, and many others center on magic that promises everlasting life. Even the Greek word nectar, from the legend of the nectar of the gods, translates literally to overcoming, tar, death, nek. If we can't stave off death, we can at least deny its obliterating effects. Most mythologies and religions center on the afterlife, an abstraction drawn from the very human refusal to believe that this life is all there is, and we'll never see our lost loved ones again. But ironically, this widely shared belief in an afterlife has done little to stem the pursuit of everlasting life. Is it not odd that Juan Ponce de León's desire to find the Fountain of Youth was in no way tempered by his devout Catholicism, a belief that promised him everlasting life already? Human technology, medicine and alchemy back then and in modern times, engineering and computing, has been heavily focused on prolonging life. Immortality has always been the biggest prize, and countless prophets, kings, heroes, deities, and adventurers have taken enormous risks in pursuit of it. Today, for the first time, perpetual life may actually be within reach. Science has been working hard to reveal the underlying mechanism of aging. As with all things in biology, the process is far more complex than we ever thought. Early research into aging revealed the discouraging truth that aging is caused by the accumulation of random damage to DNA and proteins. I call this discouraging because random damage is very hard to prevent. Modern medicine's ability to repair damaged tissue is laughable compared with the ability of the body to heal itself. If our own bodies cannot figure out how to stop the cumulative onslaught of molecular damage, what hope do our brains possibly have? The damage is not on the micro scale, but on the nano scale, and our blunt instruments can barely see it, let alone repair it. Nevertheless, new, wholly different strategies to prolong life are beginning to emerge. For one thing, science has wisely given up on the idea that cellular damage is something that physicians can repair. Instead, efforts have largely been focused on understanding how stem cells work and determining whether they can be harnessed. Stem cells are the body's built-in renewal system for tissues. Stem cells, while few in number, are dispersed strategically throughout most organs and usually lie dormant until called upon. When specialized cells are lost to injury, illness, or mutation, stem cells jump into action and proliferate, producing replacement cells that can then differentiate into specialized cells and begin to function. Scientists are finding stem cells in every tissue they examine, and it turns out that the body is more capable of self-renewal than previously thought. It was once considered a canonical truth that every human is born with all the neurons that he or she will ever have, and that the gradual loss of neurons in aging adults is inevitable and irreversible. It turns out that the brain has neuronal stem cells that can replace lost or damaged neurons in specific instances. While the information stored by a lost neuron is probably lost forever, the brain does appear able to grow new neurons. Stem cells are thus one avenue through which biomedical scientists are attempting to prolong human life indefinitely. If they can figure out how to enhance human stem cells so that they don't lose the race against cellular damage, we'd have a real chance at living much longer. But other, more science fiction-inspired efforts to prolong life are also underway. Technologies around tissue and organ transplants are developing so rapidly that doctors will soon attempt the transplant of a human head. Actually, this frames it backward. Because an individual's personality, memories, and consciousness are housed wholly in the brain, this procedure should really be considered a body transplant. If these transplants become successful, and efforts to keep brain tissue refreshed and functioning are successful, a person could live indefinitely by simply transplanting her head from body to body. Let's not stop to worry about where the bodies would come from. An even more futuristic, but perhaps more realistic possibility, is the continuing development of xenobiotic and synthetic bionic implants. Beginning with horsehair sutures to close wounds in ancient times, and continuing with hooks and peg legs to replace lost appendages in the Middle Ages, humans have long sought to overcome biological limitations with synthetic alternatives. More recently, physicians have advanced from using pig parts to replace failing heart valves to using artificial valves that are sure to outlast their recipients. In fact, scientists have now developed a whole artificial heart that can completely replace its biological counterpart. While the current limitations of artificial hearts means that the recipients must await the more lasting solution of a transplant, people have gone for years with something called a left ventricular assist device, which almost completely takes over the pumping function of the heart. Just a few decades ago, who would have thought that someone could live indefinitely and nearly symptom-free after his own heart had almost failed? That's exactly what former U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney did until he finally received a heart transplant. Even our current arsenal of bionic implants reads like the science fiction I grew up reading in the 1980s. cochlear implantation is now routine, as are arterial stents, artificial hips and knees, and glucose monitors paired with insulin pumps. Already on the horizon are artificial eyes to send visual information directly to the brain, like Geordi LaForge on Star Trek: The Next Generation. The big breakthrough will likely come as we pair our understanding of tissue renewal with the capabilities of nanotechnology. We have nearly all the tools and knowledge necessary to engineer tiny repair robots to scavenge organs for aging cells and recruit fresh stem cells to replace them. It's only a matter of time. Eventually, we may not even need to go to all of that trouble. A new technology called CRISPR-Cas9 has revolutionized science's ability to safely edit the DNA of living cells. Until recently, the promise of gene therapy was limited by practical difficulties. It seemed impossible and had proved unsafe in even modest attempts. However, CRISPR has changed all of that, and the means to slice and dice our genomes appears tantalizingly close. Biomedical scientists in all fields are racing to see if, or rather how, CRISPR can be used to cure disease, repair damage, and renew tissues. Genetic testing and counseling have already affected human evolution in this regard. Many people who have a history of certain genetic diseases in their families or ethnic backgrounds elect to get genetic counseling. Couples who discover that both are carriers of a serious genetic illness can choose to go their separate ways, eschew having biological children, or employ amniocentesis to detect whether a fetus will have the dreaded malady. The effect of these efforts is that the prevalence of these diseases in the population is decreasing. This phenomenon will likely be further enhanced through CRISPR. Couples wishing to have a child may one day be able to have their eggs and sperm not just analyzed, but repaired prior to fertilization. CRISPR could slice out the disease-causing version of the gene, replace it with the healthy version, and voila! The technology to do this already exists and will no doubt be tested in fertility clinics soon. Even more incredibly, in addition to fixing genetic diseases, CRISPR could easily be used in sperm and eggs to alter the genetics of the planned child to extend his or her lifespan even further. As we come to understand the genetic control of aging, scientists may one day be able to make tweaks to the genes of future generations such that they don't grow old in the first place. Of course, as I noted earlier, the real prize is the search for immortality. As the full picture of cellular aging and tissue renewal comes into focus, we may be able to deploy CRISPR-armed nanobots to fix damaged cells before they begin to show their age. This is not wild speculation. The first steps toward this approach are already being envisioned in animal models. Yes, the initial attempts will be modest, but if they are successful, this genie will never go back in the bottle. All the technology I've discussed here is nearly at hand, and its arrival in your doctor's office may be only a few decades away. Certainly, medical technology for prolonging life is developing rapidly, even by conventional standards, and for people who manage to stay alive until the deployment of these new measures, doctors may be able to stop, or at least slow, the hands of time. As the technology continues to develop, as it surely will, doctors may even be able to reverse, not just pause, the effects of aging, and individuals will get to live as 20-somethings forever. This notion is driving many of those near the middle of their lives, including myself, to get in shape and try to live long enough to live forever, the prescient subtitle of a book published in 2004. Where we will fit all these newly immortal people is another question, but given our species' tendency to kill one another in large numbers, this problem may solve itself when resources become scarce. Another possibility is the colonization of other planets and moons in our solar system, or nearby ones. While this may seem far-fetched because aerospace technology has not developed as rapidly as biomedical technology has, we may be approaching a watershed moment on that front as well. The upshot? Never underestimate science or our species' ability to overcome its own flaws. In fact, many anthropologists credit the development of humans' impressive ingenuity to the dramatic climate changes that occurred in Africa, Europe, and Central Asia over the past 2 million years. Biology alone could never have gotten humans through the Ice Age. We needed cleverness, too. And today, we are in desperate need of that crucial quality, perhaps more than ever before. Coda. Swords or plowshares? While no one knows for sure what the future holds for humanity, we can get an idea by looking at our past. We are a beautiful but imperfect species. What has defined our past will define our future. Because the past is filled with stories of struggle and misery giving way to triumph and prosperity, there is hope that the same will be true for our future. The struggle is clear. Our population growth, environmental destruction, and poor stewardship of natural resources threaten the prosperity that we have sought to create for ourselves. What is the answer to that struggle? How can we turn the impending doom into triumphant peace? Simple. By using the same tools and processes that helped us overcome our previous challenges, the same means that brought us prosperity and abundance in the first place. Science. You might be thinking, maybe science itself is the problem. Maybe our reliance on science and technology is our ultimate flaw. That's an understandable suspicion, but I don't think it's the reality. It is true that scientific progress led to the development of the coal and petroleum-based energy industry that is devastating the carbon balance in our atmosphere. But science has also provided the solution: solar, wind, water, and geothermal power. It is true that agricultural and textile technologies have led to massive deforestation and tremendous pollution from factory farms. But science has also cultivated the clean crops and synthetic alternatives that could one day phase out their polluting predecessors. The same commitment to scientific progress that conjured coal-powered steam engines has now developed a solar-powered airplane. While every piece of plastic ever made is now sitting in a landfill or on its way to doing so, chemists have created biodegradable plastics, and biologists have engineered bacteria that can eat plastic. Every problem that science has created, science can solve. If that sounds overly optimistic, consider this. Green buildings are going up left and right, and we are increasingly meeting our demands for energy and materials in sustainable and environmentally friendly ways. Per square foot, the average American home runs on less than half the electricity annually than it did 25 years ago. Per gallon of gasoline, the average new car goes twice as many miles as it did 35 years ago. And for both homes and cars, solar and other carbon-neutral power are increasingly pushing down the demand for combustion-based energy. Several European nations have the goal of being carbon neutral squarely within their sights, and these countries have nowhere near the harvestable sunshine that countries in the global south have. A better future is within our reach. The question is, will we be able to grasp it? Or to put it in a different way, will our advanced intelligence prove to be our biggest asset or our biggest flaw? We already have the science that can save our species from itself. We are waiting only for the will. And if we can't muster it in time to prevent a global collapse, we will have the ultimate proof of our poor design. This has been a Highbridge production. Read by L.J. Ganser. Copyright 2018 by Nathan H. Lentz. Published by arrangement with Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Recording copyright 2018 by Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.